The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hi, Maggie. I'm so glad that I have this opportunity to chat with you. And before we get started, I need to just spend a moment fangirling. I was sort of under a rock, I think, right before your book came out, between the pandemic and relocating. And somehow I did not know that it was coming out until it was actually out. So my first experience was walking into a bookstore and seeing this striking cover. It's such a gorgeous cover. And the H just grabbed my attention. And then underneath it, I saw the word Hamnet. And being a Shakespeare nerd because of theater, I knew immediately, like it was such a wonderful, weird experience to see the title of a book and know, I know what this is about. And I feel like she wrote it just for me. And I got so teary-eyed in the bookstore that that's not why I had walked in, but I grabbed it and I came home and I started reading it and then almost immediately realized it's about Anne Hathaway, who you correctly call Agnes. And I literally wept with gratitude. And I know that I speak on behalf of tens of thousands of Shakespeare nerds in the theater. Scholars might be a different story, but it just made me so, I was so grateful that you told a story that I've been wondering about for decades. And you told it so beautifully. There was this tiny little pinch of, oh, she beat me to it. But I'm so glad that it was you instead of me, because you wrote it infinitely better than I ever would have. And it just, the language, it's luscious and vibrant at the, and it's just such a beautiful story. And I'm so glad that you told it. So thank you. I needed to say that. And now I'll try and be a little more articulate and ask you some questions.
Well, thank you so much. That is quite an introduction. I think that's possibly the nicest introduction I've ever had in my entire life. So
oh,
thank
my
you.
Goodness.
That's very kind. Thank you, Nicole. It's such a pleasure to be chatting to you.
Oh, good. Thank you. So this is, given that your autobiography was just referred to, this is sort of a leading question, but I am curious if there are elements or parts of the story that were specifically autobiographical, either directly or indirectly?
I mean, it's a hard question sometimes, you know, sometimes, and I don't know if you find it when you're writing your books, Nicole, but, you know, I think fiction always is a mixture or a kind of woven thread between many strands, you know. Yeah. I think there are always going to be things that you completely yeah. make up, you know, from your imagination, and there's always going to be things that you draw from, say, books or conversations that you've heard or things that people have told you. And I think there's always going to be an element of your own self in there, an autobiography. I mean, I always feel that any novelist or short story or fiction writer who says there's absolutely nothing of me in this book, I never really believe them, do you? I think it's impossible, you know, even if, but I think the great thing, you know, it's strange, I found, you know, because Hamnet was a kind of a return to fiction for me, and fiction is my main love, you know, and I did write a memoir, which I always said I would never do, and I find that really hard. The truth is hard, and writing about yourself is hard, you know. Turning your gaze inward is exhausting, and sticking to the facts is really hard. Yeah. Some natural instinct is to make stuff up. So I just, you know, yeah. I think that it's always inevitable. There's always going to be joins in your books, you know, and I think that's why it's strange for people who know you well to read your novels, because they can be submerged in what they think is a fictional world, and suddenly they can turn a page and suddenly find, you know, a scene or a conversation that they themselves remember. So I think it's a pattern, and I'm sure there are things. I mean, to me, it's really hard. I think in a sense, the writer's probably the worst person to ask, because I think by the time, even if you do take an experience which originated perhaps in your own life, by the time you recast it and put your words into someone else's mouth or given your experience to another character, and you know, it all feels so much at arm's length that it almost doesn't feel like it belongs to you anymore.
Wow, that's so well put. Yes, 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 very well put. Thank you. What When you were doing it, you must have had a certain amount of self-awareness that there were things that were resonant with your own story or resonant with your own relationship to the play, because you have a long, you said that you had wanted to write this book for 30 years.
Well, I'm not sure I would say 30 years. I mean, I was really lucky in that I had an excellent English teacher at high school. And I studied the play Hamlet when I was 16. I did it for my Scottish Highers, so I was 16 going on 17. And I completely fell for the play. You know, Hamlet felt as though he was related to me in a sense. You know, I felt as though we shared the same DNA. He does, I think, as a character, appeal to a certain type of adolescent, definitely. One who wears too much black, someone who's a bit melancholy and maybe a lot of black eyeliner. That was certainly me. So it really got under my skin in a way that other Shakespeare plays hadn't previously. And then my teacher mentioned in passing one day that Shakespeare had a son who was called Hamnet, and he had died approximately 4 years before Shakespeare went on to write the play Hamlet. And I just remember being completely struck by the sort of almost echo of these names. And I remember even though it was a really long way, you know, a long time till I was going to become a mother or a writer, it just raised huge questions for me. I thought, you know, what does it mean? What does it mean to call your play and your character and the ghost, let's not forget, after your dead son? You know, why would you use the same name? What an extraordinary thing to do. And I mean, I wouldn't say, you know, at that moment I decided to write a novel. That would be absolutely ridiculous because I was 16, you know. But the idea just lodged in my head, I think. And then when I went to university and I studied literature there, and obviously, you know, I read an awful lot about Shakespeare. And we were this was the kind of early 90s, and we were very quite strictly discouraged from using any kind of a sense of Shakespeare's biography in interpreting the plays. It was all very theoretical and postmodern, and you know, we were supposed to sort of take this kind of postmodern, post-structuralist view on these plays. But I kept returning to the idea of little Hamnet and thinking, well, where is he? Where is he in this story? Why is he so sidelined? You know, and realizing these big biographies of Shakespeare, you know, Hamlet's lucky if he gets maybe two mentions. He mentioned that he's born, they mentioned that he's died. And his death is always wrapped up in statistics about child mortality, almost as if the inference was it wasn't really much of a deal if a child died, because so many of them died and people would have been half expecting it, which is a terrible, terrible something to make. But what I found extraordinary is that if scholars did mention Hamlet, which didn't always happen, a lot of them said, you know, it's impossible to know whether or not Shakespeare was, you know, thinking of his dead son when he called the play Hamlet. And, you know, I can tell why I'm laughing, because it's... I mean, is there a more preposterous thing to say? You know, the idea that a writer would likely or casually take the name of their fairly recently dead son and write it again and again in the manuscript and hear it again and again and again through rehearsals and speak it yourself again and again. Because there is a story, perhaps apocryphal, that Shakespeare himself took the role of the ghost in the first production of...
Yeah, I think there's something to that, actually. So that's a good point. I had not thought of that he would literally be saying it.
Yeah, he'd be saying it and hearing it. And again, in front of an audience of thousands of people who had no idea of its significance. So it just always seemed ridiculous to me to suggest that there isn't really any link between this dead son and the play. Because, you know, the names were interchangeable in parish records at the time. So, you know, it is the same name. People have debated whether or not it's an echo, but it is, you know, there are plenty of, I mean, actually Hamnet and Judith, Shakespeare's twins, were called after their godparents, who were Hamnet and Judith Sadler, the bakers. The wife is mentioned really briefly in the novel. And Hamnet Sadler, the baker, quite often called himself Hamlet, and Hamlet with a two T's or one T, or Hamlet with two. So spelling was a lot less stable in those days.
That makes a lot of sense, actually, yeah. So going back to your relationship to the material, why now? Why, having become a writer and written other books and then a memoir, what was it about now, or not now but recently, when you felt called to write it this time? What was the...
Well, I mean, it is a book I wanted to write for a long time. I had the idea, vague idea about it, and actually, funny enough, I was looking back in some notebooks. I have a notebook where it's one of my longest running notebooks, and I write ideas down. Sometimes it's a line or a title or an idea for a book, and I was looking back for some other reason, and I did find an entry from 2013 that said, novel based on Shakespeare's son, Hamlet. And at some later point, I had put square brackets around it, obviously thinking that's an idea I need to return to. So it was, and I did have several attempts at it in the intervening years. But every time I would sort of do a bit more research, and I would get some more books about Shakespeare, and I had them on my, what I call my Hamlet shelf, which, as you can see in the cupboard behind me, it's still there. And I had a go, and I had about 15,000 words, but every time I swerved away, I mean, one of the things that always delayed me in a sense was that I had an odd superstition about writing it, because I have a son and two daughters, as the Shakespeare's did. They're actually in a different birth order. My son is the eldest. And there was something that always stopped me about writing this book until my own son was past the age of 11. It was just a kind of, because I knew obviously that to write this book, I was going to have to put myself inside the skin of a woman who sits at her son's bedside and is forced to watch him die. And then she needs to lay his body out for burial. And I just didn't think I could write it until my own son was safely past that stage. Because 11 is a very, I do remember the year that he was 11, I remember observing him with that kind of sort of fictional lens, and thinking, what is it about? 11 is a very specific age of a child. It's a very intriguing age. It is it's almost the sort of high watermark of childhood. It's sort of last months, in a sense, before
yes.
children begin the slow tip into adolescence. And there's something particularly poignant about it. And I remember thinking that. But so in a sense, I couldn't begin the book. So I began the book, I think, properly. I mean, I've actually written three books instead of writing Hamlet. I wrote two novels and then I wrote a memoir. So then I thought, when I finished the memoir, I do remember consciously sitting myself down and sort of giving myself a talking to and think and saying to myself, you've either got to write this book or you've got to forget about it. You can't keep circling around it and buying yet more books about Shakespeare and taking more notes. You have to do it or not do it. So I thought, well, I'll give it a go. And I looked at the document where I'd written about 15,000 words, and I realised that I'd completely started the book in the wrong place with the wrong person. I'd actually started it after Hamlet's death. So I thought, I'll scrap all that. I chucked it all out and I started with Hamlet. I wanted to put him centre stage because that was the engine behind the book, that I've always felt that little Hamlet Shakespeare has never had his due. He's just been sidelined, and history has ignored him, and he's never been given his significance. And also, no one has ever said this child was grieved, this child was loved, and I'm not going to wrap him up in statistics about infant mortality. He was special. We, and as an audience, owe him so much. I don't think without him, without his very short life, we would have Hamlet, and I don't think we would have Twelfth Night.
That is so interesting, right? Because Twelfth Night is a male and female, is a brother and sister twin. That's Shakespeare loves twins, but is that the only one with a boy and a girl? Anyway, that's very interesting observation. And I had wanted to comment on the fact that exactly the thing that you said, many historians, but also historical novelists, will sometimes lean into the fact that there's such a high mortality rate among children to not go to the depths that they should be going to when they are describing the deaths of children. And I want to acknowledge how beautifully you handled that, and that it never feels anachronistic, and yet it feels very relatable at the same time. And that's very difficult to do when you're writing about something that is so different, that where society is so different than it was now, for instance, the mortality rate.
I just refuse to believe, in a sense, that, what a lot of historians and others, like you say, some historical novelists will say, is that because child mortality was so high, because it was so common, then somehow it was less affecting. I just don't believe it. I don't believe that any point in history, anywhere in the world, it's anything less than catastrophic to lose a child, no matter how many. I mean, if you think about Shakespeare's mother, poor Mary Shakespeare, and his father, who lost two baby girls before William was born, and then little Anne, who died age seven, losing three and burying three daughters, and then obviously they had their other children, but even still, I don't believe that any of those three little girls were anything less than loved and severely mourned. It's a weird sort of looking back, it's a weird idea to assume that people didn't grieve because it happened so often. it's a meaningless equation. Of course, they were devastated.
King John, Constance's speech, which I'm sure has come up
Oh, yes, that speech is awful.
grief fills the room up of my absent child. Nobody that doesn't know how to mourn a child could possibly have written that extraordinary speech.
And that's
And
dated
she's
what,
not.
year, 2 years after Hamlet's death, I think. Is that right?
Right.
I
Yeah,
believe.
I think it was earlier than it's believed to be earlier than Hamlet. I mean, so many of these things are conjecture, but.
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, I took as my guideline the dating by the Globe Theatre. I think, well, if anyone knows, they they've probably got the best idea.
That's I rely on them. I noticed that, and I'm not the only one, your stories, including this one, are often not linear. You are not a fan of lineality. I don't even know what the right word is, but you play around with time and you make the playing around with time part of the richness and the texture and the layers of the storytelling. And I'm wondering, in general, as a sort of a shop talk, if there is, do you have a particular philosophy about how it is that you are doing that, what you are trying to do with it, or is it different for each book? In which case, was there a particular element at play in Hamlet? What were you trying to do with that particular storytelling device?
I mean, actually, to be honest, the structure of Hamlet is probably one of the most straightforward ones I've ever written. I think probably I was so consumed with the period, and trying to get that right that actually I thought maybe subconsciously I thought, well, I'm going to need a quite a straightforward quite a straightforward structure because I want to bite off more than I can chew. But certainly, I don't really like chronology. As a kind of narrative force, I mean, personally, I don't have a problem reading books that are chronological, but I find it a bit of an imposition, really, and a sort of tyranny in a sense. I don't believe, or I don't think, it's certainly not how my mind works and my, say, memory and how our neurology is organized. I don't think our minds and our brains work very, very neatly from A to B, and they work chronologically in one direction, and we don't go back and forth at all. I suppose I envisage the human brain and the human memory as sort of more geological, that sort of layers and layers and layers are added and added and added, and there's always a constant bedrock underneath of our sort of childhood in a sense, and then something perhaps seismic can happen, and then this bedrock is forced upwards to the surface. So I suppose I envisage it more like that. And so perhaps, and structure really interests me. I'm very, in fact, I'm looking right now over this computer at the structure of my next novel, which is all laid out in this kind of slightly mad flowchart. So I always try to think of a book, especially when I'm coming to the end of it, as a, I try to envisage it as a kind of three-dimensional structure, a bit like a sculpture. And does it work? And does this, does the beginning agree with the end? And does the middle, and does it work? Does the story flow sort of outwards from the center rather than in one line from A to B? I suppose I think of it like that. But actually, in a sense, Hamlet has pretty, I think pretty much a very straightforward structure. It's in quite easy and sort of divides into two parts. And there's a kind of present day story of Hamlet's last week or 10 days of life. And then you have a slight flashback to his parents' marriage. And then at the end, the second structure is completely linear and chronological, which is quite unusual for me.
That's right. Yes, that feels almost like this, like a companion piece to the first part.
Yeah, well, I always knew that Hamlet would die. I mean, it's not really a spoiler, so Hamlet dies halfway through the book, and then the second half would be, it would end with the play, because that was always the link that fascinated me. What does it mean? Why does this boy have the same name as the play? And what is the relationship? What's the interplay between them? And what was the process? What happened after Hamlet died for Shakespeare to go on to write this play?
When you were researching it, were you engaged with the source material for the play that exists independent of Hamlet? There's an older
Oh,
story
you mean
that
the
is,
Ulver Amleth? Yeah, I did.
yeah.
I was interested in that, and I did look into it. And actually, I suppose it was just an idea of what was it that made Shakespeare pick that up? What was it attracted him about it, and how much he changed it, certainly. And I think
Yes, a
it's
lot.
just always, I think if you look at the play, Hamlet through the lens of this lost son, it feels completely different and completely changes. You know, I mean, I think obviously that's one of the things that has always fascinated people about Shakespeare and will continue to do so. The fact that there are so many different, there are myriad interpretations of these plays and people are still talking about them and will continue to talk about them. And, you know, Hamlet can be looked at in so many different ways, the play, but if you look at it through the lens of the dead son, you can see that it could be taken as a message from a father in one realm to a lost son in another. And it's absolutely heartbreaking. You know, I think of all his plays, it's the one that I think that he is most visible in as a person. You know, he is obviously, you know, he's such a mysterious figure. You know, there's so much about him we don't know, despite the efforts of the world's best scholars for hundreds of years. There's so many gaps in his story and so few documents we have about him. There are so many longueurs in his narrative. But it seems to me that in Hamlet, he is briefly visible. I mean, even obviously in the act of calling this play after his dead son, he becomes briefly visible to us as a human being, you know, as a father, as a grieving man. But also there's that incredible moment, I always find it gives me the kind of hairs on the back of my neck, when Hamlet is talking to the players about the play he has written, the play within a play, the play To Catch the King. Mm-hmm. And he takes the actors on one side and starts to tell them how he wants them to say his words. And he says, pronounce them trippingly off the tongue. And whenever I read that, I think, there he is. That's him. That's Shakespeare talking to his, you know, the king's men or the chamberlain's men. And I find it just always, I mean, it's such a kind of, it's a very, very small scene, but there's just a few words and you think, there he is. But the scene that I actually find almost unreadable in Hamlet is the description of the ghost when he's talking to his son about the manner of his death. You know, he's talking about he's lying in an orchard and his brother comes and pours poison into his ear. And then he describes the agony of his death and the poison coursing through his body. And he says it courses through the gateways and alleyways of my body. And it's horrible, most horrible. And when I read that, I mean, I passionately hope that Shakespeare made that up, that that's fiction, that it's plucked from his imagination. But I have a horrible feeling that it's him describing Hamlet's death, because it's so close to contemporary accounts of watching people die of the Black Death, because it is, of course, that your body poisons itself. You know, the buboes poison you and you know, you'll eventually die of blood poisoning. And I actually find it almost unreadable because I can't bear it. I can't bear that that might be Shakespeare or Agnes watching Hamlet in his final hours.
Wow. Yeah, that's very... Yes. Speaking of Agnes, I would like to talk about her for just a moment, because she is so... If the book was not called Hamlet, I would describe it to people as a book about Agnes. She's so central and she's so present, and your depiction of her and her life, and she's such a remarkable woman. She has so much agency for a character that exists at a time when women had very little agency. And she's so believable. Did you intend for the book to be as much about her as about Hamlet, or did that grow as part of the process of writing it? Did it take you by surprise?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, I don't know about you, Nicole, with your books, but I'm not much of a planner with either in life, actually, or in fiction. You know, I always have a sort of a direction or an end in mind, but often in the writing of the book or in the process of it, it often changes and it tends to go off in another direction. But actually, I always quite welcome that. I always feel that that's a moment where it's a sign that the book is working, you know, when it takes on its own pulse or its own direction. I kind of think this is good. You
having
know,
an book. Adolescent temper tantrum and it wants to go and do
wants
to. Yeah,
exactly. The book's kind of acquired its own heartbeat in a way. But actually, so I did originally plan Hamlet to be about fathers and sons and about ghosts and absence. I had a whole plan that it was about going to be about Hamlet's ghost. But actually in the writing of the book, I realised that the absence... the impossibility of being able to communicate with him after death was what would be the most devastating, in a sense, you know. And maybe the play, in a sense, is a wish fulfillment in a number of ways, because not only has Shakespeare taken Hamlet's death for himself, for the father, and let the son live, there is this perhaps and also a wish fulfillment about the father and the son being able to communicate with each other, even though they're divided by death. perhaps anyway. So I had originally planned it as that, and it would be in sort of theme a bit closer to the play. But actually, what happened was I became really I don't know if distracted is the word, maybe enraged is a better word, at how the woman we've been taught to call Anne Hathaway has been treated in the last 400 years since she died, and that's by biographers and scholars, other novelists, writers of Oscar-winning screenplays, for example. We've been taught only one narrative. There's only one single story about her that has been pushed on us, and that is that she is an older, illiterate, stupid peasant woman who lured this boy genius into a marriage that he regretted. He hated her. He had to run away to London to get away from her. I've read very respected Shakespearean scholars saying that she was of loose morals and that it was questionable whether even the baby was Shakespeare's at all, that she was ugly, she was stupid. It's absolutely jaw-dropping. If you read these books in succession, you just think, where is this coming from? Where is this vitriol coming from? You know, are we so wedded to the idea that we need our male artists to be footloose and fancy free? You know, why? Why is it there is this such a strong urge to give Shakespeare a retrospective divorce? I mean, I couldn't find a single shred of evidence for any of this stuff. I mean, just for an example, to take the idea that the criticism of her that she's ugly, there is one portrait of her in existence that was a pencil sketch from an Elizabethan original that was done 80 years after she died. And I mean, it's there on the internet, anyone can see it. But in it, she's got this very sort of narrow face, quite serious, very grave expression with high cheekbones. And actually she bears a very striking resemblance to the actress Saoirse Ronan, who I think we can all agree is pretty far from being ugly. That's my son coming in. No, he's gone. it's all preposterous. And, you know, her detractors will always invoke the famous second best bed behest in the will. You know, but actually, if you look at the will, it is a very dry document. You know, people have always said, you know, he shows no affection for his wife, which proves he hated her. But actually, there's no affection in the will at all. It's a very, very dry document, very fast. There's no affection in it at all. He lists, you know, a small number of behests for his friends and family. And, you know, but it's, and also what's never mentioned is two things, actually, that the second best bed behest is an interlineation. It's squeezed in between two other lines. And, you know, I mean, he was dying. So, you know, you wouldn't think that the will was written by the same person who'd written, you know, the best lines ever about love. But also by Jacobean law, his wife was entitled to a third of his estate, which was vast. I mean, he was the equivalent of a multimillionaire at this point in his life. And also she was entitled to stay on in their house, new place, until her death. So this idea that has always been pushed upon us that she was a sort of rejected wife who was chucked out on the curb of a street in Stratford with just a bed to her name is preposterous, absolutely preposterous. But what's always seemed most potent to me, or most important to me, is that at the end of his career, when he retired from the stage, he was living in a single room lodging in London, and all his money he had sent back to Stratford. So he bought his wife and daughters a mansion of a house a year after Hamnet died. And he had also bought cottages and fields. He owned land and fields. So he leased them out. So he was very well known as a landlord in Warwickshire at that time, which, you know, doesn't imply to me somebody who regretted his marriage and hated his wife. But also when he retired, he could have set up a household anywhere he wanted when he retired from the stage. But he came back to Stratford. He chose to come back to Stratford Moynihan and live the final years of his life with his wife.
Yes.
Now, would a man who regretted his marriage do that?
No, definitely not. Also, I wish I knew who it was that said this, but the other thing about the second best bed is that in households of that nature at that time, the best bed was saved for guests and the second best bed was the marriage bed. So there's actually, especially if it was added afterwards, in a sense, it's almost like a coded love message.
Yeah. Caroline Duffy has written a really beautiful sonnet about it called Shakespeare's Wife. And in that, she makes that explicit. So basically, the best bed would have been in the parlour and it would have been reserved, like you say, reserved for guests. And the second best bed was probably the marriage bed. But who knows? But it's either way, I don't think this very single clear narrative that we've been pushed about her is true. You know, I think their marriage was a partnership. I think they did love each other. And I think he was thinking about, you know, I mean, I know you have to be quite circumspect reading too much of his biography out of his plays, but his plays are populated by a remarkable number of very true, intelligent, faithful wives. And I don't think they come from nowhere. But I think probably the most lightning bolt moment for me about the character of Hamlet's mother came when I read the will of her father. So Richard Hathaway was a sheep farmer, a very successful, respected sheep farmer. And he died a year before she married William. And in it, in his will, he leaves her a very generous dowry. And he refers to her as my daughter, Agnes. It would have been pronounced Annis or Agnes at the time. But that was a kind of thunderbolt moment for me, because I thought, you know, on top of everything else, have we been calling her by the wrong name for 400 years? You know, it seemed particularly emblematic of how she has been misrepresented and maligned that we haven't even got her name right, for goodness sake.
Right, absolutely.
So I just wanted to give this name back to her to show readers that this is somebody you haven't yet met. This is a new interpretation of someone. And please forget everything you know about, you think you know about Anne Hathaway, and open yourselves up to a new idea.
Absolutely beautiful. And the telling of it is just gorgeous. So actually, I want to turn it over to questions from the audience now. And one of them is quite resonant with what you're just saying there. Could the fault of the historians be because most of them through time have been men?
But I think it's possible. I mean, I think also, you know, there is a sense, and that, you know, there is a lot of sense that, you know, that there is a reason why scholars and biographers have focused on Shakespeare's life in London. You know, I do understand that, and that's where the story is, in a sense, isn't it? That's where the big events happen. But I suppose what has never really been excavated much is his life back in Stratford. You know, his home life. I think people have always been. Or people who studied Shakespeare have been keen to emphasize and amplify his career, obviously. You know, I mean, his career is the big deal. You know, I understand that, and we all understand that. But what interested me, I think, is the story, that the sort of unexamined story back behind him. And, you know, I have always felt, ever since that moment in my classroom when I was 16, I've always felt that the biggest drama of Shakespeare's life happened off stage, and that's with the death of his son. So I think it's a more nuanced situation than perhaps, you know, the scholars and historians being men. It's a bit more, you know, complicated than that. I mean, I would say actually that and the woman we know as Anne Hathaway has had a big champion in Germaine Greer. Germaine Greer has written a fantastic book called Shakespeare's Wife, which is an amazing work of scholarship, so meticulous and carefully written. So if anyone's even remotely interested in finding out more about her, please get hold of that book and read it. It's a fabulous read.
Thank you for mentioning that. Here's another question. Why do you choose not to use Hamnet's father's name? You refer to him as the tutor, the glovemaker's son, etc.
Well, for a number of reasons, actually. The first one would be that, you know, his name carries so much significance and heft. You know, it doesn't even necessarily, I think, you know, I think for me, the book was largely about names. You know, obviously Hamlet's name with its incredibly famous echo, and the Anne/Agnes name, and how, so it's a sort of about what names mean to the people and how they can become detached from the person that they once belonged to. But in a sense, you know, Shakespeare's name, I mean, it seems preposterous to even say he's famous. You know, he's sort of a long way beyond famous. You know, I think probably it's one of the names that's most recognizable in the whole world, I think, in a sense. You know, I think you'd probably be hard pressed anywhere in the world to find somebody over the age of, say, 11 or 12 who doesn't know who he is. So his name, it carries almost too much heft. You know, we all have our own relationship with Shakespeare inside our head. You know, he pervades and defines our very language still. So I just needed to remove that. I wanted to ask readers to see him as a human being, not as the literary behemoth that he will eventually become. But also the other reason was that I found, in a very practical sense, that I could not write a sentence of fiction like, I don't know, William Shakespeare came through the door and decided he was hungry and so sat down and let his breath, you know, even saying it sounds ridiculous. And so I would type it and then I would suddenly think, no, I feel like a total idiot. I can't write this book. This is all pointless. So I just, in a sense, I just had to, you know, just take the name away, because I wanted people to forget who he was in a way, and just see him as a person, as a human being,
as a member of the family. I thought that was a brilliant decision, beautifully done. Another question. What influenced your portrait of Shakespeare's father as so brutal and nasty? Is there any historical evidence of his bad treatment of his children and grandchildren?
Well, I should say that it's quite possible I owe an apology to the real John Shakespeare. It's possible that he was a very lovely man and perhaps he and William got on like a house on fire. I don't know. What I will say is that, we have very few documents about William Shakespeare himself. You know, there are lots of gaps in his story and he left a very scant paper trail. By contrast, his father, John Shakespeare, has an enormous paper trail, mostly because he got himself into a lot of financial and legal problems. So he had been very successful. He'd been the most successful glover in Stratford-upon-Avon. He'd been a high alderman, which is the kind of biggest sort of civic accolade you can have. And he was allowed to sit in the front row of church. He had special ceremonial robes. It was a bit like being mayor of the town at the time. But around the time that William got married at the age of 18, the family fortunes had taken a huge nosedive because John had started illegally trading in wool. So in those days, you had to stick, it was very strict laws about sticking within your guild and sticking to your trade. So nobody knows quite why he decided to do this because he was already pretty successful, but he started illegally trading in wool and he got into all kinds of legal wrangles and he got into vast amounts of debt. And there was an account I read that said that he very rarely left the house because he was so worried about going into his, running into his creditors. And he was also got into legal problems and got fined and summoned to court for really strange things like not attending church. So he had to go to church once a week. That was against the law not to. And he also got fined. There's a document that shows he was fined for dumping what was described as ordure in the street just outside their house. So you can imagine what that was, you know, for a man who, you know, created doves for a living and skinned animals and tannery. And I don't know, it's just a horrible idea of what it could have been. So I just, from this, I got this picture of somebody who was quite erratic, whose behavior, whose sort of downfall was created by his own ambition. And it doesn't, that there are quite a lot of instances in Shakespeare's plays of men whose ambition is their downfall and who are undermined by a certain, their reach exceeding their grasp, you know, and they're often tyrants actually. You know, I'm thinking about Macbeth or Coriolanus or Titus Andronicus. And so it was from that that I created the character of John as this quite violent, erratic man with a temper. But as I said, there isn't particular evidence for that in the biography, but it was just a kind of extrapolation and interpretation of my own. So maybe I need to apologize to him.
There are a couple of questions here about the flea. People would love you to talk about the flea.
The flea, yes. Well, the flea was one of those instances where the book sort of went off on its own tangent. I hadn't planned for the chapter about the flea at all. It was something that just arose. You know, I think at that point in the book, it sort of comes just before the midway point in the book. And I remember worrying at that point that the book was a bit too hermetic. It takes place in a small town and in pretty much in one or two houses in a small town in a rural part of England. And I just felt that I needed to kind of throw the book open at that point. And a bit, you know, I suppose as a film director might suddenly pull the camera back. And I suppose I was just interested in, or I became slightly, shocked actually, because I was researching the play. I mean, I should say that it's not known what the real Hamlet Shakespeare died of. His burial is recorded, but not his cause of death. But so my fictional Hamlet dying of the plague is my own invention. So I was just starting to research the Black Death, and I was so horrified, so taken aback by the sort of facts about this disease, you know, the prevalence of it and how it was so fast and it killed people so quickly and it was so horrific, and the sheer numbers involved in these outbreaks of these pandemics. You know, there's one particular outbreak in the 14th century which killed a quarter of the world's population in 1 year. And that was only Europe and Asia, because of course it hadn't reached the Americas at that point. You know, it's just jaw-dropping. And it's, you know, the fact that it could kill someone in 24 hours, you know, completely healthy, young 20 something person in 24 hours. So I felt that I wanted to dignify the disease in a sense and dignify people's suffering. You know, the suffering of previous populaces under this horrific bacterium. So I just felt that I needed to show that it's global potency in a way. So I just decided to write this chapter. And actually it was the bit I was most worried about at the time. And I do remember writing a note to my editor in the margin saying, do you think this is okay? You know, is anyone going to care about this other than me? You know,
oh,
I didn't know whether it was just a kind of, you know, for about a fortnight, I'd gone down this sort of little alleyway and I was studying Elizabethan trade routes and I was looking at these sort of arrows of infection coming all the way across from Asia through Europe and, you know, all the ways where these boats were picking up furs or dropping off spices or, you know, picking up clothing dyes. And I thought, you know, I'm really enjoying this. I find this fascinating, but I have no idea if anyone else will. And then I spent a particularly grisly couple of days researching the life cycle of the flea. And if you ever want to be really revolted, just look that up because it's horrible.
Oh.
Yeah, so no, it was. So I didn't know if it was going to work or not, but I'm glad now that it's there.
We all are, I think. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a couple of people asking a very similar question, which is Hamnet willing to give his sister his life. Where did that moment come from? What was the inspiration behind that? It's such an unusual. It is a very unusual angle into who dies and who survives.
Well, it was two things actually. I mean, one of the things was a biographical historical fact was that Judith, Hamnet's twin, surviving twin, she lived until she was in her early 70s, which for that time in history is astonishing, absolutely jaw-dropping. I mean, the average life expectancy was 47. So I'm now 49, so I would have been a very, very old crone, or you know, if I was there at all. So in a sense, I remember when I worked that out and I added up the numbers and looked at her burial date, and I thought, you know, it's almost as if she lived two lifetimes. And then I suddenly thought, oh, she had her own life and then she had Hamnet's as well. And also I have to say the kind of the twins changing places comes directly from the plays, actually, you know, because boy and girl twins, as we were saying, is a sort of reoccurring trope or motif in Shakespeare's plays, and he often plays it for comedy. So as we were saying in Twelfth Night, which features boy and girl twins who are separated and they each believe the other is dead, and then there's a kind of comedy and sort of romantic confusion plot where one of them dresses up in the boy's clothing and they get mistaken for each other, and then they're magically reunited at the end. They get mistaken for each other and they're magically reunited, and they fall into each other and say, I didn't know you were still alive, which is it's so heartbreaking when you think about what he must have been thinking about his own boy and girl twins, who of course would never
be reunited. I never thought about it that way before, but now that you say that, it just gives me chills. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. A question. It just jumped away. I'm still learning how to use this thing. Did Saunders, Lincoln and the Bardo influence your research for this book?
It didn't. You know, it's funny, I had started writing Hamlet when Lincoln and the Bardo came out, and I had a terrible moment where I read the description of it and I thought, oh God. You know, and I do remember I rang up my agent and I said, oh my God, have you seen this book? Not only is it this, it's also brilliant. My God, have you read it? You know, and she said, you mustn't worry, it's going to be different. Obviously it's going to be different. She's, I mean, yes, it is. And what's extraordinary is they're both 11, those boys. Which is really, it's amazing, isn't it? And it's, yeah, I mean, God, it's a brilliant book. Jaw-droppingly amazing and inventive and fascinating. But I mean, but actually I did have a slight panic, but then my agent was right, because of course they are going to be different books. You know, they're from different imaginations about different men, different times in history. So, I mean, I wouldn't say, I don't know, it would be hard to say influence it. I mean, Lincoln and the Bardo was so... It's in a whole sort of category of its own, isn't it? I mean, no one could ever try to replicate that or even come close to it. It's such an astonishing work, a sort of masterpiece of imagination. So it was great. When I read it, I thought, of course, yeah, it is going to be different. Of course it is. I mean, nothing could be like Lincoln and the Bardo, could it?
It is truly an amazing book, although so is this one. Another question. There are a lot of questions. We definitely are not going to be able to get to all of them. And so I apologize in advance to anybody who posted a marvelous question that we don't have time for. But this is something that I had wanted to ask as well. So I'm going to. Is there any historic information about Agnes's brother? He becomes her rock, her constants. Her constant. That's Bartholomew, I think, is...
There's not a great deal about Bartholomew, actually, other than that he was the one to extend the Hathaway farmhouse. So in their day, I mean, if you see anyone has ever been to Stratford-upon-Avon or looked at pictures of what is now called, referred to as Anne Hathaway's cottage, it's this very kind of pretty thatched cottage of two stories. But in her day, it would have been just a single hall where the children and the parents and shepherds and all the animals would have lived. And there was no chimney. So there was just a fire right in the middle of it. And there was a hole in the thatch for the smoke to come through. So you can imagine what that looked like. You know, everything happened in that room, you know, living, cooking, washing, eating, everything. But Bartholomew was the one. And the only hint that I got from him about him was that when I went around the houses in Stratford-upon-Avon, which of course I did as part of my research, when I was walking around Anne Hathaway's cottage, I went up to the second story, which Bartholomew put on. He extended the farmhouse greatly in his day. And the door frames, the door lintels, were surprisingly high for a Tudor house. I found, you know, usually under the, when I'm about 5'8", I'm not that tall, but I'm, you know, slightly above, taller than average. And I found that I was having to duck in all the houses except in Anne Hathaway's cottage, which I could walk through quite comfortably. And I thought maybe he was very tall.
Yeah. Excellent.
That's good. It's just that one kind of tiny detail that made me think he was a big colossus of a man, which is what I made him in the book.
Which works beautifully. This question is going in a very different direction. My son was killed in an accident at age 29. You have captured the grief a mother feels at the death of a child, especially touching child's clothes. How were you able to get these feelings across? Did you have experience with death?
Well, first of all, I'd say I'm so sorry to hear of your story. That's just heartbreaking. I can't, it's unbearable to even think that that could happen. I'm so sorry. I mean, what I will say is that I do think that grief is sort of the other side of love. So I think if you experience loving somebody, it's not a huge leap to imagine what your life would be like without them. I think loss is a great part of love, or fear of loss is a great part of love, isn't it? Because I think a lot of what makes up that emotion is the fear, or the idea of what your life would be like without them. So it's sort of an inversion. If you imagine it's like a glove pulled inside out on itself, it's the other side of love, isn't it?
Brilliant image. Yes. This is related, although less personal. I have read in reviews that this is a novel about grief. Do you agree with that characterization? After all, the first half focuses on the family's daily life before the loss of Hamnet. That might be a fraught question to ask someone if they agree with the reviews, but
I don't ever read reviews. That's one of the reasons I don't really like hearing myself. I don't think of it as a novel about grief. Obviously that's part of it, but what I think it's about is why. I mean, it's about names for me, and it's also about why we need art and why we make it, and how it comes to be. You know, it's about the kind of genesis of art. You know, in a sense, I always think making art, or reading art, or watching it, or listening to it, or whatever it is our refutation to death, isn't it? It's about saying, this is who I am, this is where I am, this is my answer to life. And I think that's what Shakespeare is doing when he writes Hamlet. Obviously, it's a kind of metabolization of grief that he has undergone. But he's said this instead. He said, this is what I think. Yes. This is my flag in the world.
Yes. There are a few questions that essentially are asking why you think Hamnet was so overlooked and ignored for so long, not simply the fact that he was, but if you have any thoughts about why.
I suppose perhaps it goes back to the focus on Shakespeare's career, you know, which doesn't really need any explanation, does it? You know, I think that's always been the big narrative, you know, and I think perhaps maybe his domestic life has just fallen into shadow. One of the things that I read when I was researching the book is that by the time, so like I said, Judith lived till her early 70s and Susanna lived till her late 60s. Even though, unfortunately, Judith actually had a very difficult life. She had three sons, all of whom died. So one of them died as a baby, and the other two died in their early 20s within a week of each other. And Susanna had a daughter, And she married twice, but she never had a child. So there is no there are no direct descendants of William Shakespeare because of that. But his two daughters did live for actually an incredibly long time. And by the time they were old ladies living in Stratford-upon-Avon, so Susanna married a doctor and Judith married a vintner, and they ran essentially a pub. Shakespeare's reputation, which had gone into abeyance for quite a long time, was rising again, and people were putting on his plays again, and people were writing the first biographies of him. But not one of those people who wrote in biographies thought of going to Stratford-upon-Avon and asking his daughters, what was he like? Tell us about him. What did he eat? You know, what did he wear? What kind of a person was he? And it just really gets me. You think what we would have if one of them had thought to do that, what details we would have access to, how we would know so much about him, about the person he was, and actually how his domestic life could have been illuminated, and his family life and his life in Stratford-upon-Avon, which, as you know, as we've already discussed, is a lot more significant. You know, the idea that he went away to London, never came back and ignored his family, which has been pushed and given to us, it's presented to us, isn't a reality. He obviously had very, very strong ties back in Stratford-upon-Avon. So I think if that had happened, everything would be different. So much about him would be different, and our relationship with him and our knowledge of him would be different. But unfortunately, we don't have a time machine to turn that back and go and ask them. I would like to, if anyone invents a time machine, please let me know.
I just thought of a question that is not, it's not one of these. I'm going to go off topic for a minute. Have you seen or watched or know anything about Upstart Crow, the BBC comedy series by Ben?
No, I haven't seen it actually. It kind of came onto my radar when I was probably about halfway through this book. And I actually deliberately resisted not watching it because, you know, obviously everybody, you know, I was saying everybody has their own version of Shakespeare. And I thought I can't let that one in case it sort of gets mixed up with mine. I know my son's a fan. Maybe I should see it now, actually. Do you think I should? Do you like it, Nicole?
I enjoyed it. It took me a minute to accept the fact that what's his fellow who was the Black Adder? Oh my God, I'm blanking on his name. That he was not Shakespeare because his voice, Mr. Bean, what's it? Rowan Atkinson. Rowan Atkinson belongs to Ben Elton's, like the two of them seem to go together. But once I got over that and realized somebody else is actually going to do that, I think that you would enjoy it. I think you'd get a kick out of it. There may be times that you scream at the screen, but maybe in an enjoyable way. My idea of a perfect dinner party would be you and Ben Elton talking about that. thank you for that diversion. I would love that. I'm going back to the very patient audience's questions. I don't remember another historical novel that integrated so well the fact that most people could not read. Was this difficult?
It wasn't. I mean, I think it's important to be, you know, true to the facts as much as possible. You know, so much has been made by a lot of scholars about the fact that the wife of William Shakespeare couldn't read and how terrible this is and shocking. But actually, you know, what daughter of a sheep farmer would have been taught to read? You know, and I think it doesn't really need to be stated that illiteracy is not necessarily doesn't necessarily go hand in hand with stupidity. I mean, you know, it doesn't even need to be said, you know. And also that there are other forms of intelligence, you know. Yes, perhaps she was illiterate, you know. Perhaps she and her children never actually got to see one of his plays. And I don't know. It's impossible to know these things, you know. I find it really hard to believe that he wouldn't have shared some of his work with them, even if they weren't able to come to London to see, you know, to see his plays. I mean, let's not forget that it was, you know, a 4-day journey from Stratford-upon-Avon to London. It's not like today when you can just hop on the train, you know. So I don't know. But I think you have to be respectful of that and understand that it was a completely different time and that there were other forms. You know, that was the story I wanted to write for Agnes, that there are other forms of intelligence, and her intelligence isn't like his, but it's intelligence all the same.
Good. Yes. What was the inspiration for Agnes's psychic tendencies?
Well, it was twofold, really. I mean, like I was saying, it was a very sort of strict society in a way, 16th century England. And it was illegal not to go to church. And of course, it was illegal not to be Protestant, you know, to be a Catholic, which is possibly what Shakespeare's family was, but that's another story. And so, you know, but I do believe that if there's any sort of very strict, particularly strict religious society, that it, even though people are going to be obedient to that, there's going to be an awful lot of undercurrent underneath it. And I do think that it was, that, you know, people were much more closely tied to the natural world and to the natural cycles of the day and paganism. And, you know, I do think it existed. And, you know, there's an awful lot of prophecy and second sight in Shakespeare's plays, you know, and augurs and, yeah. You know, obviously the witches of Macbeth and Julius Caesar. And, you know, it runs through the plays very, very, very clearly. There's a very strong sense of it. So I wanted to be true to that, to allude to that. But also I was very intrigued by the idea. I was trying to imagine when I was writing the character of Shakespeare, of what he would have been like, what he was like before he was Shakespeare, you know, what he was like as a young man. And I was imagining how he must have been, he must have stuck out like a sore thumb, you know, in rural Warwickshire. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's possible he went to school until he was 15, but imagine, you know, we know now, of course, what his imagination and his intelligence was capable of. We know what was inside him now, but as a 14-year-old, 15-year-old, you know, he must have been extraordinary at school. You know, imagine being his Latin teacher or his rhetoric teacher or his Greek teacher. I mean, you know, having that imagination and that brain in your class, that intellect. So I was just trying to imagine what he was like. And I think he was probably actually seen as a bit of an oddball, really. Don't you reckon? I think he must have been, he was very unusual. And he obviously didn't follow in his father's footsteps. You know, he probably had no interest in whatsoever in becoming a Glover. And I just wondered if people had seen him as a bit of a wastrel somehow. I don't know. So that was, and I just like the idea that maybe she was the one. I mean, it actually goes back to what the book I was talking about with Germaine Greer. You know, she said that people have been asking the wrong question about their marriage. You know, for years, people have said, why did he marry her? Why did he marry this older peasant woman when he was such a genius? But actually, she says we should have been asking, why did she marry him? You know, she was from a very respectable family. She had a good dowry. And actually, she chose to marry this young, wageless, tradeless boy of 18. And I was thinking, well, maybe she saw something in him. Maybe she was the only person in Warwickshire who saw his potential. So that's where it all came from.
That is most excellent. We only have time for one more question. So I'm going to do an amalgam because a number of people have asked about your feeling about this coming out during a plague year ourselves, during a pandemic year. This is, I'm sure, something that you've been asked to talk about a lot, but were you surprised or concerned about the book dealing with the plague coming out in essentially the middle of a plague? How has that impacted your, here I am trying to throw together four or five different questions all at once. I'm sorry to be inarticulate.
Well, it was strange. Obviously, I never saw this coming, you know, and actually for me, in a sense, when I was writing the book, the idea of the plague was sort of quite in the background. It certainly wasn't in the foreground of the book. You know, it wasn't the most important thing about the book to me, sure. But I think I remember, you know, I do remember having the thought of sitting in my house and thinking, you know, I wonder what it is like to sit in your house and know that there's this terrifying disease coming towards you that you have no defences against. And what would it have been like for a whole town to be shut down and for, you know, guards to be stationed at all the entrances and nobody was allowed in and nobody was allowed out and everyone had to stay in their houses. You know, it is peculiar looking back and thinking, you know, obviously, you know, where we are now and looking back to then. So it was strange. I mean, I think my initial fear was, you know, my book Hamlet came out in the UK the first week of lockdown.
Oh my gosh.
I remember when I heard that, I just thought, this book's going to sink with that trace. There's no bookshops are open, you know. No. It's just I'm just going to have to, you know, write it off and think, well, I'll just write another one and hope for the best, hope for the best next time. So, I did. I mean, I do remember thinking that, having a conversation with people and just thinking, oh, well, you win some, you lose some, you know, and obviously that's not, you know, it's the world's tiniest violin. We're in the middle of a pandemic and here am I worried about bookshops, you know, so it was strange. But in a way, you know, I think, in a sense, you know, I think having gone through this, you know, very, very strange year, I think in a way it can deepen our sense of empathy with previous populaces. You know, if you look at what they went through again and again and again and the constant outbreaks and the sheer numbers of death, I think in a way, you know, we had to remember that we are in a better position than them. You know, we know how our plague is being spread, and they had no idea at all. It was only at the beginning of the 20th century that people realized it was, you know, spreading through lice and fleas. And, you know, they had nothing. They had absolutely no defenses against it whatsoever. No antibiotics, no ventilators, no doctors, no nothing at all. So I think it's, you know, I mean, that's why we're so fascinated with the past, isn't it? That's why we are constantly going back to it and thinking about it and rewriting it. And because, you know, our past explains our present and vice versa.
Yeah, that's very true. Everything that you're saying is so... It is so compelling, and I want to just keep listening to you. And I have just been alerted to the fact that it's actually time to say goodnight. Thank you so much for being here. This has been a really, really marvelous conversation. And I was delighted to be here. And I hope that I have an opportunity to hear you talk about this some more, because I just feel like there's endless amounts that your depth of research and your passion for the material is so infectious and so interesting and enjoyable to listen to. So thank you so much for sharing it with us this evening.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much, Nicole. It was really lovely to meet you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.